Welcome. You're listening to Refusing to Implode Politely, a show all about London spoken word, with me, Zoe Stegosaurus.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Simmer down, simmer down, simmer down, simmer down. Simmer down, simmer down, simmer down, simmer down, simmer down. So here we are again. One MC and two white men, same wall to a new lens, same tales with a new pen. Brand new scenes, get a grinder and a few leaps, sit tall, go lean. Desperate men with impossible dreams, more than you know, more than you've seen. Down the twisting curves and lanes, past the pit bulls and great danes, a thin line between infamy and great shame. Details change, but the big picture remains the same. It's a long race, move with less haste. The first place is death, bring marriage and shoes to the sprint. Stand tall in the jungle with animal prints. Give love, take hints. Preachers have your sermons, let the papers have their version. We hold our corners with big beans, beats and verses. I am my own person. Sit up, kick your feet out, aim for the stars, sing to the street lamps. We come guaranteed with a street stamp. Beach house in the ear cans on the 35 top deck. Friday we sign on, Monday we rise up with a heavy head for our crimes and a bad cough. The neighbor snigger, he's a bad on. Clouds unzip, the thunder drums go bad on, bad on. This might be the day, it might not. Blood in our beating hearts, no cyborg. You find you like us, they might talk, but they ain't righteous, they ain't got the right nuts. Take a hard left. Two kinds of people here, those who left and those who are left. Cobblestones quarrel over who's the hardest. Pass it. Loud, not properly. No God, so the odds protect me. What's inside is what I'm projecting. Take a hard left. Got love and hate for the city. Between the rain and the concrete, there's no pity, no kidding. Head barks the orders, pen does the bidding. When written, still winning. Head barks the orders, the pen does the bidding. Yeah, the voice, you know it's me. Pure art, no strategy.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Refusing to Implode Politely. I am joined today in the studio by Joshua Idehen. And I'm just going to give a bit of context because I can't help it, right? I had a really lovely, wonderful, heartwarming gig last night and it made me happy. So I'm kind of on a buzz now. And I get to interview someone who is like largely responsible for me being on the spoken word scene at all. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Refusing to implode politely. I don't know why that's the first time that the name has actually resonated. It's kind of lit up all the light bulbs in my head. Like, well, that's a wonderful name. It's very nice.
Do you know what? It's Caleb Femi. It's a lyric, well, a line from one of his pieces.
Ah, scene.
And it's, I love that scene. And it's, yeah, it's like the kind of part of what I'm talking about on the show is based around people, creatives living in London and having to kind of scratch around in the dirt to make things work.
Like chickens.
Like chickens.
Like talented chickens.
Like headless chickens.
In a free-range apocalypse. Wandering around, you know, scratching down in between the dirt, you know, trying to find some corn cob nobody else has pecked on yet.
Exactly. And then sometimes having to resort to cannibalism.
Finding diamonds and realizing you're hungry. And unfortunately, there's no shop that trades diamonds in for corn cobs.
It's a shame. And you haven't even got thumbs to pick up the diamonds.
No, you have to claw them. And, you know, sometimes you might see some corn cobs, but you just don't have the wings for it.
Just occasionally, you might lay a golden egg. But it's very rare and it's difficult.
It's very rare, it's very difficult.
Catches you by surprise.
Yeah, and then it turns out that you can't crack it and no one else can crack it and it just sits there and you don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And eventually, after years pass, you begin to resent the golden egg for existing because it feels like everyone just knows you for that golden egg and all the other chickens are like, you remember when you laid that golden egg back in 85? That was good. You should do more of that golden egg. You should totally lay like about 20 more.
Is that golden egg called My Love?
No. Burn. Is it that kind of show? Is it that kind of
it
show?
Can be that kind of show.
All right, cool. Okay. Well,
oh,
let's go then.
No, man, it's good to see you. And yeah, what are we going to start with? So, apart from that madness, I want to talk to you first a little bit about, just give us an overview of what you are doing creatively at the moment. Like, I know you as a spoken word artist and as a teacher as well. But I also know that you're doing a lot of music and you have different musical projects. What is your role there?
I am part of a band called Hue. We've just finished our album.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very lovely album. If I do say so myself, in my very best Donald Trump way, it's a lovely album. You're going to love it. It's the best R&B album you ever heard. It's just fantastic. It's amazing. I can't believe I'm on it, but
you're going to build a wall around every other
album. I'm going to build a wonderful wall around the album. It's going to be beautiful. It's going to be the best wall you ever saw. So that's kind of like my main thing. I do it with Izzy Brooks, Andy Highmore, and Martin Kolarides. And we have a gig on October the 12th, which Electroworks, which you, by the time you hear this, it's probably gone.
No, it's good. I'm editing this and it's coming out soon.
All right, cool.
I want to promote you.
Awesome. If you hear it, then definitely come down. It's going to be a fantastic gig. We've just released a song online called Look Back in Laughter, which is doing quite well, thankfully, which is always great. And yeah, that's kind of what I'm mostly focusing on. The other project I've got, I have another band called Binner City. We just recently released a track in support of all of the venues that have been closed in London over the last 6 years. It just premiered on a show called Four to the Floor, which is affiliated with Channel 4. It's on Facebook. Check it out if you can. I featured on Shabaka Hutchins' The Comet Is Coming, and that's kind of like a punk, jazz, psychedelic outfit. Really lovely guys. They just got nominated for the Mercury, which is great. It was great, lovely thing you want to stick on the CV.
Yeah.
And I think that's me up to date. That's it.
Cool.
I teach, I write poetry, and I sometimes buy Google VR glasses. And I get them for free. outside counter station.
The most important and exciting thing that has happened to us this morning is, like, we were wandering past Camden Station. Well, you tell the story because I'm sure
I was wandering past Camden Station when we met, and we were just passing by the station itself when I noticed that there was a crowd of people gathered around what looked like a little a booth where someone was giving away stuff. And, you know, giving away stuff is, I think, very, very, it's the dangerous words to have around a freelance poet. So I had to go check it out. And then, lo and behold, it is free cardboard Google VR glasses.
You're not really doing this justice, because it wasn't just I had to go check it out. It was I had to, like, squeal like a child and rush towards
God. Listen, I did not, I would just like to clear, I didn't squeal like a child. You can't prove that in a court of law, so I don't even know why you would mention it. I went there like...
You think I've only just started recording?
Yeah.
I've had you all morning. This is...
that wasn't me. That was my twin, and I'm happy to have killed him. But I went there like a respectful human being. I waited my turn, and I picked up this wonderful, wonderful piece of kit, which I'm going to use with my iPhone to watch a very, very rudimentary VR experience.
Other types of phone are available.
Yeah, other types of phone are available, but I only have an iPhone, and that's what I'm going to use. iPhone 6 is a wonderful piece of kit. Yeah, that's great.
Okay, so we have these, like, but basically it looked to me like someone's giving out cardboard boxes. I thought it was some kind of, like, Rye Vita or something weird like that, and then
it's magic.
I got proper lesson this morning about all about VR glasses and TVs and 3D-ness and stuff.
Yeah.
So I've learned a thing.
I've learned a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, screw face, you know we ain't serious. Serious, no long face like Leona. Do or do not, don't try like Yoda. 2013, change your persona. Keep that lime away from my corona life. I'm on the magic quest to be the biggest tree in the big old forest. A lady luck's bosom is the one I will caress. The audience, attention at arrest. But sometimes things don't go to plan. Life will deal you with firm backhand. I'm in the pothole spinning my wheels.
I really know how it feels to be
stressed and ting. It all blows up in your face and ting. Failure, bitter like tonic and gin. Don't know how to begin again. And the missus said stop it. You're unattractive when you're grumpy. Drop it. Put your palaver behind you. Trust me, one day you're gonna look back and laugh.
You're gonna look back and laugh. You're gonna look back and laugh. You're gonna look back and laugh. You're gonna have to let it pass. I know it hurts, but just relax. One day you'll look back and laugh. You'll look back and laugh. You're gonna have to let it pass. I know it hurts, but just relax. One day you'll look back and laugh.
Good. All right. So you've got this gig coming up on the 12th, which is exciting stuff. And I want to know, like, I've seen you recently at Boxed In. Seen you recently at Inuelem's Rap Party.
Okay.
Both times doing your excellent poem, Black. Is it called Black?
You know, I haven't actually got a really good name. I haven't got the right name for it. At the moment, I'm calling it somewhere between Black Says and Black Lives Matter, just because they're the only things that could come to mind. But no, I haven't. I'm still struggling to really name it. It's still untitled in my head. But yeah.
Yeah, not important. Most things are untitled in my head.
Most cool kick-ass samurais don't really have a name, you know. So the best Clint Eastwood movies, he didn't have a name. He was just a man with no name who just wandered in and shot people. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Am I saying my poem as Clint Eastwood?
I mean, you didn't entirely say that, but the listeners can interpret.
Young Clint Eastwood when he was still good looking and not obviously racist. But yeah, that one.
I mean, the seeds were there.
The seeds were there, but they hadn't. They weren't fertilized by anything. By oodles of cash. Yeah. Nothing like oodles of cash to make a man racist.
Oh man, so it's great that you're freelance, really. Like, stay freelance, guys. Stay freelance.
Stay freelance and poor. Stay with as many people as possible. Don't be rich, don't buy a limousine, because first you become conservative and then you become a bastard. But yeah. Carry on, yeah.
Never sell that golden egg. Never grow thumbs.
Never grow thumbs.
Who is even listening to this? Okay, right. Yeah, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that piece, because I think that's an excellent piece. And you were telling me this morning that it takes you a long time to kind of incubate a poem. That one in particular, can you tell us about, firstly, the process, like what inspired it? You know, it's kind of obvious, but tell me. And then, like, how did you go about writing it? How long did it take? Was it a big slog? And how did it develop?
Yeah, it was a bit of a big slog. I'm not going to lie to you. The first line in that poem, I thought up in 2014. Yeah, and it was Black is desperate, Black wants to negotiate, Black wants his dignity, and Black will give you twerking. And that was the first bit. And I remember telling it to a poet friend, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to write this comedy piece where Black is kind of like this kind of a funny speaking character who's just there, and he's constantly just, you know, he's basically taking all of the grievances. Because at the time, you know, Black Lives Matter had just started. You know, Trayvon Martin case had imploded impolitely. And you know, we had the Eric Garner and I think Sandra Bland had happened. No, she hadn't happened at that time. She was happening this year. Was it this year or last year?
2015.
Yeah. So, yeah, at the time, I had the idea of writing it because I was, had gotten really, towards the end of 2013 into 2014, mostly in 2014, I had suddenly, at the time, I'd realized that atheism, the movement, was a misogynist piece of crap. Yeah, it is. It has real misogynistic roots. I mean, atheism as itself is fine. It's great. It's wonderful. I'm an atheist, so that's cool. But as a movement, you know, it most of its leaders are misogynistic, are Islamophobic, and are just, you know, generally, and there is a very strong line of racism that runs through that. And if you believe in intersectionality, you shouldn't even wait for the racism to show its face before you're like, no. And I had to realize that I had participated in that, and that made me kind of seek into myself and redress myself, and then pour some of my energies into, like, in my own way, tackling social issues. And at the same time, Gamergate started. Now, as you know, I'm a gamer. I went out and squealed like a little girl for VR glasses. I am a gamer.
That can't be proven.
Yeah, that can't be proven. So that was, the whole Gamergate became sort of my entry road into discovering about intersectionality, more about feminism, more about trans rights and trans activism. Because a lot of, like, especially female activists online who are trying to raise awareness of these issues, they get attacked.
Yes.
And I was part of, like, a whole group of people who decided to try and support as many people as possible. And in my own, kind of like, away from that, I was always thinking, well, what else can I do? So part of one of the things I decided to do was, because gentrification was very big for me, and it was a big issue for me, we made that part of the music in Benin City, because homophobia was still something I was kind of like, one of the few things that really annoyed me about religion and about my own capitalism. That became a song for Hugh. And then with the Black Lives Matter movement, I knew I wanted to write a poem. But I think when you get that initial idea and that initial spark, especially when it comes, for me, especially when it comes to like really topical social issues, I always have to at first weigh up the pros and cons of me tackling it, me being involved, because essentially it's an American movement. It's an American phenomenon. And when, as an outsider, you're coming in to discuss that, you need to be aware, I feel like you need to be aware of the degrees of distance that you have. And you need to ask yourself if what you're saying is something that you have to say. It's the same way, like, of why I haven't written a poem about feminism, because I always ask myself, like, I'm not a woman. You know, I'm never going to be a woman. So therefore, why am I writing a poem about, even if it's the best poem about feminism ever and it's great and, you know, all the women hear it and they start ovulating and crying and their hair just glows absolute green and yellow like they're, you know, Dragon Ball Z, Saiyan super characters and they just want to hug me and take me and make me loads of fucking chicken, even if that's the case. Even if all of that is the case.
I think you're a bit confused about what happens when a man and a woman love each other very much.
You'd be really surprised. You know, if you have experienced real love, you would know what the science open has to head to is.
I'm looking forward to the chicken. Can't wait, this is still ahead of me.
So yeah, you've got a whole life ahead of you. It's gonna be wonderful. You're gonna turn 13 and be like, oh my God, is this real love? Chicken. even if that's the case, even if all of that was waiting for you at the end of you writing this great poem, I feel like there are a lot of people who are involved, knee-deep involved in that stuff. There are women who wake up with all the women problems within and without daily, and they have much more info. And wouldn't it be better if you just highlighted, used your platform to highlight and direct to other people who deserve to be raised up to that platform or to be given an even bigger platform to talk about that stuff in depth, right, to the point. And so that's something that I had to weigh up, because I just felt I can't write a poem about trans activism. I can't write a poem about feminism. All I can do support these people and just be there and try and obviously kind of like reduce the amount of sexism that's already within me, and transphobia and ignorance that's within me as I go along. But with Black Lives Matter, I think the tipping point was this year when kind of like just because I wrote a poem about the referendum. That was like the first one. I stayed up all night on 23rd, it was crying, and then I wrote a poem about it. And then we had that week where it was, I think it was Aalto Stirling and Finlandia Castle both died back to back. And it was kind of vague, just weirdly similar circumstances. You had someone who was holding a registered gun in a state where open carry was allowed. And for some reason, you know, they got shot, like just because they had a gun on their person. And even in one case of Finlandia Castle, he actually told the police officer within his car, whilst his car had the daughter at the back and his girlfriend on the side, I have a gun, but I'm reaching for my wallet, and this man shot him. And you know, and then on top of that, we had MZ Mohammed, who had passed away, I think, here in the UK and in Italy, a Nigerian refugee who had, you know, they had crossed the sea, they had lost his son, they landed in the UK, and an ultra-naturalist just killed him on the street. And I just thought, like, okay, you know what?
This is not exclusive to the States.
It's you know, Black Lives Matter as a movement might be, but the issue is not exclusive to the States, and it's not an issue that just is summarized by a certain culture that loves guns and has problems with black people. This is something that's been happening everywhere. And, you know, the Black Lives Matter UK kind of kicked off and really came into force and became a life of its own. And a lot of people were discussing this issue and talking about it. And a lot of the grievances that the UK black population has with the police came up to the fore, you know, and using Black Lives Matter as a launch pad to discuss that, yeah, fair enough, we don't have our cops walking around with guns, but there is discrimination, there is racism, and there is undue harassment from the police towards black community and towards black men. And, yeah, so I think when I settled that dispute, I was like, all right, cool, I can write the poem. And then it took a day to write, to get everything down. My poems usually, I usually have like a line that represents a section. And then afterwards, every other line after that line is me trying to expand on that section, trying to essentially think, the best way to describe it was Shane Coison. He says, when you're writing a poem, you should look at it as basically every single section is a circle. Like the poem itself is one big circle, and every line inside you're just trying to match circles that all link back to themselves, and you're expanding. And at the very end, you come back to the main point at the beginning. You know, like if you can bring your last line towards your first line, that's great, because if you've done it right throughout the entire poem, you have expanded. So even though the lines are the same, if you hear the first line, the last line again, which was originally the first line, you would have gone on a journey where that line means something new to you.
Yeah.
Right? So, if you start saying, like, black is tired, do you understand, at the beginning, and then you list a whole bunch of grievances, and then you expand on those grievances, and you use metaphor and simile to show people a different side, to show people your side of this story. By the time when you come to black is tired at the end, people now completely understand why you are tired, why this is important, why, you've essentially railed at them for 5 minutes plus, about this tiredness, how this feels to you and how they can put themselves in your shoes. And and then after that, it's, you show it to a few people, they tell you it doesn't suck, you trust them, that they're not filming you behind your back and waiting for you to embarrass yourself, and then you perform it in front of an audience, and you're always going to make mistakes, which is great. It's actually great that you make mistakes, because at least for me, I tend to learn to remember stuff by remembering the embarrassment from the mistake. Yeah.
We learn from pain.
Learn from pain. Remember when you said, you were going to say sorts, but you said shorts, and everyone went, shorts? What the fuck does that mean? never do that again. And then you memorize it, and and then you perform it repeatedly. It doesn't matter how many times you practice it, it's performing in front of people that is a real practice, because that's when you it marinates into your tongue and you understand, like, the internal rhythms, the little moments of rhythm that you've created, not just the end rhythm, not just the end rhymes or the inside rhymes, just that those points where your grasp of the English language and your accent and your dialect and the colloquialism that you've come to all just marinate together with your feeling to create a moment where you can just essentially get lost in the words.
Yeah.
And that's only something that comes after constant practice. And with this poem in particular, it's been great, because it's been the most recent poem where I've actually gone through all of those stages where I've written it, worried about it, finished it, performed it with a piece of paper, decided to memorize it, felt the words just kind of coming in, and actually gotten to that point where I don't even need to practice it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I perform it, I'm hearing new kind of discovering new moments of fluidity within it. And it's I thought it was terrible, and everybody else likes it, which is just kind of like par for the course.
I think that's something to think about. That's always something to think about, is the fact that we are our worst critics. We are always going to see, I think just in everything, not just in art, but in everything, we're always going to see, you're going to see yourself as aspiring to the thing that everyone else has got or other people have got, and they see you as equal.
Who's your inner critic, if I'm allowed to ask questions?
Who's my inner critic?
My inner critic is Rufus Wainwright.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a mix between Rufus Wainwright and the first two albums of Alex Turner.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry, because no wonder you feel like you're way down there.
Yeah. Because you think, like, you write a line and you think, that line is good. And then you remember Rufus Wainwright wrote, life is a game and true love is his trophy. And then you can see Rufus there crossing his legs going, would I say that line? That line you've written, would I say that? Would I say that in a room full of people? Would I say that at the Royal Albert Hall? Sold out? No? Maybe you should write that again.
Don't do this. Do you know what, for a long time I just didn't bother writing, because I thought, I'm not going to be Shakespeare, am I? Shakespeare's done already, we've had that.
He's made 700 words, I haven't even made one. The best I came up with, bloopty bloop, and that turned out to be a word already made.
Am I right? And then after a while, that sort of matured, and I was like, wait a minute, I don't have to aim to be Shakespeare. I can just aim to be like something good that I can do.
Yeah,
and I can
aim
work
to be,
on
aim to be you.
Be Rufus.
I'm not trying to be Rufus, but I think it's great to have an inner critic. I think it's great to have an inner critic. And I think it's great to have an inner critic whilst also having people who can read your work and tell you it's not terrible. And also kind of like above my, I have two quotes above my laptop. The first one is, no one should judge a fish by its ability to climb.
Climb a tree. Yeah.
And the second one is the forest would be a really dull place if only the finest birds could sing. And I really like that quote because it basically is saying, like, you know, everybody isn't the same. You know, some people are great with metaphor, some people are great wordplay, some people are great with rhyme, some people are great with narrative, and some people are just a mishmash of everything to come into a whole. And I think it's great to strive and it's great to kind of, you know, struggle to be the best that you are. And it's great to have, and internal critics are good for that because, you know, because I love Rufus Wainwright, I'm able to hear all of his terrible lines as well, all of the kind of like basic lines that he's written as well as the great ones. And you know, you have to see that full picture. And I think at the end of it, internal critics just essentially, for me, they're just helping you to become better people. The idea is your internal critic is not telling you, don't do that. Like, you know, why are you even picking up the pen? The page was better when it was blank. I don't understand why you ruined such a perfect thing.
Because you say it's not telling you that, but then, like, coming out with something so deep just off cuff like that, I feel like you've been through that process with Rufus, and now you've got to the other side.
No, it's not really, not really. I think what it is the same to you, like, okay, take, for example, if you wrote a line like, you know, you know, his eyes were dangerous, you know, and just like Rufus, just like that is a dumb line. Unless you're going to a preschool, don't show that line. Maybe you can write that as a metaphor. Maybe you can find, you know, and then you say, you know, his eyes were two snakes in the grass. That again, and then he's like Rufus, like, well, that's nice, but snakes in the grass is a bit bait, you know what I'm saying? See if you come up with something, you know. And then you can say, you know, his eyes are two foxes, you know, two foxes hiding out in an old woman's flat, and it's like, boom, the flat is a person, the two foxes are his eyes. You understand? Whoa, you've already created an image that says something. And then you know, you can expand on it, you can extend on that image, because if the man is an old woman and his eyes are two foxes, then what's his mouth? What's his tongue? What's his you know, his tongue could be like an old sofa that everyone has sat on, you know what I'm saying? And you can go with this metaphor, you can take it to different places. His brain is a bedroom with no one sleeping in it. Oh my, oh, also even better, his brain is a bedroom with the ghost of all his former lovers. Whoa!
Oh my God, this is happening. Life.
You know, then suddenly you're coming out with it, and that's what an internal critic is for. And that's just from you just saying, let me step away from just, oh, you know, say his eyes have grief, you know. Because I went to a night and a girl wrote a line and she says, you know, if the body is a home, then I am a dislocated shoulder. I'm a dislocated knee. And I just thought, wow, because the whole poem was about nomadism and not finding a home. And just the idea, you know, if the body is a home, then I am a dislocated knee. Like, whoa, where you come with stuff like that? And you can, I mean, yeah, sometimes, you know, when you're in the mood, when you're in the zone, you know, you could have just written that off. But sometimes, you know, you were there, sat there for ages thinking, if my body was a fish, then I am... a wishbone? No, that's not it. That's not the one. If my body was a PlayStation, then I am a disconnected part. Not quite. You know, and you drink, you walk around, and I can spend ages. I don't know if you do this, but I can spend ages on a line. I can spend a long time, you know. I have this thing. There's a poet called Joel Taylor who you should definitely get down. She's an amazing poet. Oh, yeah, you saw her down at her.
Yep.
I do this thing with her because I really love her. I think her poetry is so good, and she's really good with metaphors. She's really, really good at capturing, like when she says stuff like, you know, oh, your smile was a switchblade, and you're like, oh my God, that's such a powerful line. And every time I see her, like, because I've told her, like, every time you perform and I hear a metaphor, my brain immediately goes, quick, think of something better. So I tease her. I just go up to her and I'm like, yeah, I've got it. My face is a telephone that nobody answers. Oh my God. And she's just like, whoa! And I'm like, yeah, don't worry. I'll make it better. I'll polish it off. But yeah, you know, I think that's what an internal critic is for.
Is there a name for this disease? Because I think I'm like stage one and you may be like stage four, irredeemable.
If I was to call it disease, I would call it, you know, it's a search for the shiver-itis.
Ooh, yes. Wow.
And I call it that because I think as writers, not only do you appreciate the pain and the suffering, but you appreciate the craft. You know, when you first heard Shakespeare, I think everybody, when you first heard Shakespeare, you're like, oh my God, he's using old language. I don't get what he's saying. He's making words that don't make sense, and it really hurts my head. And he's so boring. I just want to watch cartoons. Go away, go away. And that is kind of like, especially when you've got a person in your, the teacher, some failed drama student. Not to, teachers are great, but sometimes all of my poetry teachers before I went to university were crap. All of them in Nigeria, they were all terrible. Mm-hmm. Actually, the only good English teacher I actually had who actually believed in me was from Ireland. Deep. Anyway, so yeah, you know, you have that bad teacher who's just like, Romeo, where are thou, Romeo? And, you know, it just totally puts you off. Yeah. Puts you off poetry, and it puts your, you know, teachers are better now. I have to say that again. Teachers are much better now. They have to go through so much work. But back in my day, they were crap. And then you have one teacher, in my case, Akala, who shows you a different side of Shakespeare. For me, the line that got me reading Shakespeare again was, let us make medicine of this vengeance. And I was just like, do you understand? You know the line is good and you see the images, but you have to sit there and stare at it and be like, how does this line work? Let us, so you got vengeance, right? And then you're milling vengeance. You're milling the motherfucker. And it turns into medicine. And you take the medicine of the vengeance to give you more. Oh, it's such a good line. It's just, and you know that. And so when you, and I think this is at a point after appreciating and reading a lot of poetry and kind of like understanding metaphors. And when you hear people do great metaphors or do great work, it gets a shiver at the back of your neck. Do you understand? A really good shiver. And I think, you know, when you're writing and you write a good line, you get some of that shiver.
You do.
You get some of that, like, that little jolt, like, oh, my God, did I do that? Oh, my God. Oh, what great power. Crap power lays in these hands. Oh, my. You know, and you get it. And then it lasts and it's, you know, you perform it. And, you know, when you perform it, you might do a little pause just before you deliver the line. And everyone goes, And maybe some people at the club, they clip, people at the back, they clip their fingers and they make it, you know, they let you know that line was a deep one. You understand? Or they laugh or whatever. And you also appreciate this in other people's work, because that's what gets you to, you know, to push yourself further, you know, because you might write basic ones like, you know, the man was a catfish, or the man was a fool, or the man was a lion. And then you hear someone say something like, "Wars and Shire, everybody wants to go home unless home is the mouth of a shark," and you're just like, and just the back of your spine just yeah, liquid vice. And you're constantly searching for that. I think it becomes problematic, because at times you write really great metaphors, but because you haven't got the shiver yet, you can't say, yes, this is good. You don't feel this good because you haven't got that same shiver. So yes, it's a search for the shiveritis.
I like that very much.
Yes, that's the disease. That's the disease. It's terrible. It's terrible.
We all got it. We're at different stages. There's no treatment.
There's no treatment. It gets worse. It gets worse till you quit.
Yeah, or somehow, like, you're just in constant, like,
I
don't know how that's going to work.
I thought up a metaphor. Oh, my God, I can't stop thinking about the metaphors. My whole life is a metaphor. Oh, my God, that's a great metaphor.
Oh, man, I am enjoying this, but I think we're going to have to wrap up, sadly.
Okay.
I know, yeah. It's just like, it just flies.
It just flies.
Every episode
flies.
It's
absolutely a flying episode.
For us. Probably the listeners are like,
For other people, it's like, no, this episode of the chicken, it wasn't flying anywhere.
I do not believe
you laid a golden egg this time.
Oh, just lots of little ones. Little
just little tiny
planting seeds.
Tiny little seeds, little gold,
infertile.
gold plated specklings.
Gold leaf eggs.
Gold feathers.
Or like white gold. It's not real diamond, it's like zirconia or something. Anyway, so tell us how we can find you if we want to stalk you and stuff.
If you want to stalk me, I'm on Twitter as, if you type in Joshua Dan, you should find me. But if you want to find my Twitter account personally, it's Benin Citizen. This is BENIN with Citizen. Or you could look for my other band called Hugh, which is at Hugh Love Hugh. Just think Hugh Grant, but take out the Grant and stick Love Hugh next to Hugh.
Good. So we got those. And have you got any fun courses coming up that people can do, or
fun
anything like that?
Courses. I currently work with Ambassadors and Ambassadors and the Poetry Society. So I do a lot of teaching in schools, but I am doing, I really do want to look into kind of running like just a course, maybe like a day long workshop. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, I am doing a performance poetry module day-long module with CityLit. And it's good.
It's good. In November, right?
It's in November, November 19th, if it all works out. I think they've got halfway through kind of getting a pact. Now, if you want to learn from a Mercury-nominated poet...
Who's that?
I was on the album, okay? If you want to hear from a Mercury... if you want to hear from a poet who's done this for like about 10 years, then...
And who is not jaded.
Not jaded, not twisted at all, doesn't have like some of the best songwriters on the planet in his head telling him to quit and move into pig farming, right? Come to me. I will make your dreams metaphorical.
Oh, they were so solid. Why did you melt them?
I just melted your dreams. I melted your dreams, yes. I wore your dreams like sandals and I ran down the road.
Love it. Oh, man. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming in. And
thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And I will leave you with Joshua's last track. Take care, guys.
The man and his madness go toe-to-toe. Said the man and his madness go toe to toe. He's on the losing side of the battle, and I swear he knows. I said he's on the wrong side of the wall, and I swear he knows this. I swear he knows.